call to order and welcome to the policy committee meeting today. Just in confirming the agenda, item one there on the agenda refers in the final sentence to the following appendices that are circulated separately with the agenda. Actually, that's a just a formatting error. There aren't any appendices with this actual committee or any of the papers, so it's a mistake. So I'll just note that. So we can confirm the agenda just with that small tweak. Conflicts of interest, any of them? No. No public forum. Minutes have been circulated for adoption. Does anybody care to move those and try an accurate record? Councillor Noon. Seconded Councillor Hope. Any matters arising? No, we'll put that then. All in favour?
Aye.
Against? Carried. We have the actions noted there. They're quite straightforward, as you will see. So terms of reference is the first one completed, and the next one is an item on this today's agenda. Okay, then on to the agenda. First of all, we have the director's report, and just note again that there's a slight mistake in it referring to attachments, so we just need to correct that when we get to that part. However, it is open for discussion, and plenty there. Mr. McRae, did you want to touch on anything?
No, but I'll certainly answer questions.
Sure. Okay, I'll just open the paper up. Councillor Scott.
With Sylvian Dale here, simply reaffirm what I said earlier, that you know, it was, a, in my view, a very successful water quality urban forum held in the Art Gallery, and there's various processes going from there. There's a reference group meeting Friday week, pulling together of all the information, and I think it'll be time to reconnect with the council as a whole. And I think there's going to be a council workshop in terms of urban water quality. Is that fair, Sylvie Dale? What date was that again?
18th.
Oh, so that must be around the council day. Mm-hmm. So that'll be a positive thing. But anyway, a big thank you to staff for their work. The question is in relation to the Urban Development Authority. So the government released a discussion document, Urban Development Authority, a proposal introduction of authorities to enable national or local significant urban development projects to be built more quickly. Submissions closed in May. And I think what it says is potentially this authority could have powers greater than the district metropolitan plans, including the RPS. And it's really just to ask or discuss, you know, any Otago examples. So, you know, where do we envisage or expect the possibility of one of these authorities being used? You know, like, is it a for a particular project? You know, like, is it a Queenstown thing, or is there a potential, if we had a significant project here, that such an authority would be used? Do we see it being utilised in Otago, and what are the issues, is my question.
It's not inconceivable that it wouldn't be used in Otago. Primarily, it's a territorial council-controlled authority that's created with powers to get on and do the job. So it's really sort of... The concept comes out of somewhere like the Auckland housing crisis, where an organisation has to get together, get out there and be able to go and do the job in its entirety and not get tangled up by other parties getting in the way of that process of going from vacant paddocks to real estate. Otago concept wise, arguably South Dunedin might well be somewhere where you want to say we want to go straight past the regional policy statement, the regional plan, the current district plan, and we want to be able to move in and acquire the properties under the Public Works Act and do the job. So there's potential for that sort of, I'll say, getting out of a legacy situation. Equally, in Queenstown, where there is the special housing area provisions are already working, and it takes that sort of focus on getting housing done and puts it in the hands of an organisation with that focus to get housing done.
Yeah.
And so essentially somewhere in a rapid development area, Queenstown obviously would be a place where there could be a potential.
Yeah, so
whether either of those councils are of a view to go there, yeah. I have no knowledge. I have
but
no
are you concerned about that, them having powers that could supersede the RPS and all the work being put into?
Well, yes, in the sense that it puts the focus on housing at the sole discretion and the sole consideration of the single agency that is doing that sort of development. So the idea of expertise from another organisation being necessarily considered or had to be considered, effectively, you know, without being too fine a point on it, inside one of these organisations the judge's decision is final, no correspondence will be entered into. They design what they want to do and they get on and do the job. So it's about assuming, you have to assume that they will act very rationally in their considerations.
Thank you. On that note, thank you.
I've got a couple of hands up. Are they on urban development? Okay, Councillor Kempton and then Councillor Laws.
I'm pleased that Councillor Scott brought this up. This is pretty significant, very, very significant. And I think that as a council, we ought to be making sure that those who are writing up our submission on this have our thoughts front and central. I'm looking at this maybe slightly oddly, but this is RMA reform by 1,000 cuts. Their government doesn't have the numbers to do this kind of thing in under the name of RMA reform, but some of these kinds of things are the kinds of things that they wanted to do anyway, and so they're going to do it. Now, rightly or wrongly, I think that there's more than just the question of housing involved in this. I'd be concerned about if the land is being compulsorily acquired under the Public Works Act, then the Crown ends up owning it, but at some point the Crown won't want to own it, and at what state is it when it's then passed on? How does the... Is this going to be, if you like, a housing corporation development in perpetuity, or is there some point in the process at which it would be passed on? I think we need to find out a bit more about that and get some ideas together around that. And then, of course, the whole question of simply saying, well, somebody is making the decision for our region on whether or not we're going to have more urban sprawl. They're just going to say, you guys need more houses and you need them now because we want to control the price of housing or whatever the political imperative might be. And that's the place out there on the Tyree where we built the cheapest. Right? And so there it is, done. You know, you're getting... In some respects, it's a government empowerment thing, a bit like the Clyde Dam Empowerment Bill, where they're simply saying, we're just going to push everything aside and we're going to stuff some things over there. And I think that we should be really, really careful about that. I'm not saying there isn't a case for some level of streamlining, but this, in fact, is a very, very blunt instrument. Thank you.
Can I just correct a little bit there, which is this could well be the Crown, but it could well be a territorial authority as well.
Yes,
does it?
Yes. Well, same effect.
Yeah, absolutely same effect. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, guess the following paper as well with some of the resource legislation changes as well follows similar themes, which we'll discuss then as well. Sorry, Councillor Laws.
Yes, I'm not quite as alarmist as Trevor. My understanding of this piece of legislation from reading the section from the MB relating to regional councils is that we still have considerable input into the constructions of urban housing areas. And my understanding is that more it's intended to streamline what is, I think everyone admits, an extraordinarily convoluted system. The only area in our neck of the woods that's likely to be affected is Queenstown, and potentially, no, not Auckland, Wanaka, it would be Queenstown. And I'm very keen, Gretchen, on seeing our response before we put it in. So will we have the opportunity to look at what our submission would be, Gretchen, before we send it into the discussion document?
What's the time frame for
it? It's a fairly tight time frame, but we we can certainly circulate that. And
Nineteenth of May.
Can we get it to a draft to the council?
Yeah. Yeah. That those that want to do it, I suppose, is the quickest way. We send it to everybody and just accept.
Yeah, send it to everybody, and you can then receive any feedback
So there is the two documents that are referred to here, and one of them does the latter one, the better urban planning one, does include regional councils. The previous one, though, completely goes around any other planning documents or other organisations. So it gives those urban development authorities carte blanche, if you like, to get on.
If we do have it circulated around everybody, we could also name a group that therefore has final responsibility for putting the submission together, a bit short notice as well, which pulls together.
Self and the chair or something like that?
Yeah.
If the chair and the deputy are responsible for collating all of the feedback
that we receive and making that final submission.
Yep.
That sound okay to everybody? Yep. Right, so we've done better urban planning. Right, urban development, now we're on to better urban planning, which is a similar theme. Is there anyone wanting to touch on that one specifically? ORC policy plans and strategies section then. So we've got some updates there on the RPS and our water quality strategy, biodiversity strategy, and a proposed plan change for the Lower Waitaki Aquifer. Anybody like to comment on any of those?
What page are you on? Jesse? 89. Thank you.
Section 2 of the director's report. Water quantity then, updates on the Lindis, where we're at with Cadrona and Arrow, and then Herakia as well. Thank you, Aunt 1D, still sitting on the table. Anybody like to comment? Yep, we've got plenty of hands up. So, Councillor Deaker, Councillor Pentland, and Councillor Wiggins.
I just wanted to focus, thank you, Madam Chair, on 3.3, the plan change 5C. I like very much the proposal of working this plan change through in those three paragraphs, but it's in the third paragraph that I see the sentence, the draft plan change will then be workshopped with councillors and presented to the community for feedback later this year. And I'm asking the same question I did this morning in a different context, whether that workshop will be open or closed. This is a very significant matter of public interest, and I'd have thought that we would probably have it as an open workshop.
It would. I would have thought it was a normal council workshop. Which is... scheduled at a time normally after a council round or a committee round, whether they're specifically closed to the public or not. They're certainly not advertised for the public to come to normally, but
So the intention then sounds staff is to have it as a workshop rather than in public. But we're having the discussion. Councillor Scott, then Councillor Woodhead.
I mean, it seems to me, because what they're proposing here, I mean, there's obviously going to be a lot of community interest here. And if we have an open workshop and people are hearing things second hand, in Alexandra, it depends where you have the workshop, but if you're having it in Dunedin, you may find that we cause more problems than we actually solve, as opposed to one clean presentation to the community. If the workshop was open, in my view, it would have to be done in a way, and even a location, so have to maximise its impact in the community, so there's no second guessing. If that's not the case, then maybe a closed workshop with a formal open presentation, community for feedback, as a proposal, is not a bad idea.
Can I just clarify the process steps?
Yeah.
The suggestion that here is that we would have a workshop with the councillors to run through what we are proposing as the final plan change. We would then take that to, in the case of the Manuherikia, Omakau or Alexandra or somewhere that's in the catchment, to workshop that material with the community prior to locking in on what would be the plan change that we are going to notify.
And that notification process would be a formal process of a committee or council where we would
then have to come back and say this is, we would then have to come back to this committee and say this is the plan change we are proposing to notify.
Yeah.
And then it goes through that first schedule process.
I think you probably understood that as well, Councillor Scott.
Oh, yeah, no, I understood that. I suspect that what you're proposing is the way to go because, if you have an open workshop here in Dunedin, people are just going to get, it's not going to be effective communication. And I think what you're actually proposing here is effectively to have that open workshop in Alexandra, but prior to that, there'll be an in-house councillor interaction
briefing. Can we say that the in-house one is a briefing, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, so I think what you've got is probably reasonable. Yeah.
Okay, I did have Councillor Kempton next, and then I had the other hands as well. Yep.
Yes, it wasn't exactly what I wanted to talk about, but I do believe that we do need to have a session to quietly consider what Council's position is without the influence of others, at least one, and it's really important. Just a question of the social impact, cultural impact, and economic assessments around proposed plan change 5C. Now, we got economic assessments, we commissioned those for the Lindis minimum flow regime. My understanding is that submitters also prepared economic assessments of some sort or another. I just wonder whether whether we can reflect on what we produced for the Lindis and take any learnings from that and make sure that we're refining the process and we're getting something that's as robust as it can be in terms of economic assessment for Manuherikia. So whether we're looking very much with a continuous improvement focus.
Yep, definitely.
That's great.
Yep.
Cool.
Councillor Lord and then Councillor Neil.
Gretchen, I just wanted to raise that because Michael's making, I think, a more general point here, which is how we do our business. And you were talking before, Michael, about cut-through and how we bring the community into the decisions that we make. I don't think we should be scared of having our workshops as a general rule in public, to be honest with you, because if you present something, Fraser, for example, and we discuss it and robustly debate it and then come up with a proposal, that's just the democratic process of work, essentially. And really a workshop is no different really than a working committee meeting. So I mean, there's nothing commercially sensitive that we'd be discussing. There's no invasion of the privacy of individuals. And we're all adults, so I don't think that we'd have a problem as a general rule.
It's all commercially sensitive.
Well, no, it's not, because we're about to go and put it out. Commercially sensitive is no one's going to be making investments based upon workshop decisions that we make or a draft.
Consultation still, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Still so I just want to say that, I just say going forward, it would be nice, because Michael's raising a larger point here, and that is, if we have workshops, unless there's good reason, why don't we just let them be open? And see our process at work. I think it would make things a lot more transparent and easier.
Okay, thank you. Councillor Neil.
Oh, I'm happy with the way it's actually proposed. And one of the things I like about workshops is that you get a sort of a debate which is different again from open debate where people can make political points. And on this particular issue, there are many, many opportunities to grandstand. And the public are getting plenty of input, which I'm very pleased to see, and still input after the workshop as well. So to me, I think we need at least one good thrash out in non-public.
Do you think that'll stop grandstand?
Non-public it will.
Okay. Councillor Woodhead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The wider issue here that's the basis for a question and some commentary that's been made recently, and it was touched on earlier.
Oh, yes.
And that is to do with the relationship between a dam, whether it's an existing dam or a proposed dam, and the minimum flow. And in my view, there's some confusion in the community around that, and some appear to be assuming that a dam that's different to an existing structure might have to deliver the minimum flow, which actually in my understanding is not the case, Mr. McRae. That a dam will have a consent and it will have some conditions around the operation of that consent, which will likely to include outflows, but they may not necessarily be directly linked, and in fact I'd be very surprised if they were, to a minimum flow. And for example, if you had a dam in any catchment, put aside 5C for a moment, where X was the inflow of the dam, but we had a larger number Y further down the catchment than was expected, but there's tributaries, we've got a complicated catchment. You cannot, it would be quite unusual for a dam to be the sole provider of that minimum flow in a, for example, extremely dry season. Are my assumptions correct? And yeah, I know.
Yeah, who knows?
I know. There's a whole lot of
your decision may actually come to.
I'll attempt to address it
today.
And how can we? There is definitely some confusion in the community.
Yes.
Around this, how can we assist to clarify that?
To try and play it with a straight bat as best we can every time we play it. This is the best way we can do what we can. Whatever we do is to be as honest as we can at all times. There are some accusations that we create numbers so that we can then collapse numbers and we look good and that sort of stuff that's been out there. That accusation has been in the media. But essentially, the a large dam up a catchment called Manuhirikia does have a residual flow maintenance because it does cover the bed of the river itself, so it stops everything, and the condition of that consent is that a certain amount of water has to keep coming out. That's not designed to maintain a minimum flow mid catchment, but that is to make sure that they do not stop the flow in that river. So the river from that dam down will continue to perform as it did before. There are dams in New Zealand, and there's one recent one in Tasman, where because of the agreements around the funding of that dam, some of that water is stored is deliberately let go to maintain a flow at a point in that catchment. So depending on the makeup of it, depends on the role and function of the dam. Is it an irrigation storage dam or is it a catchment management storage dam?
Both.
So you can get those situations.
Thank you.
In the case of this one, I understand it's purely at this stage seen as irrigation, but is required to let water go through because it is blocking the flow of that river.
In the form of a residual flow condition, yes,
at the dam itself.
Okay,
we're
getting into my understanding
discussion on details of a plan change rather than an update on the process of where we're at. So, Councillor Bell.
Yeah, it's my understanding is that, through you, Madam Chair, Fraser, that water, they've got to release it. That's what Roger was telling me, the manager, to fulfil their requirements at the camping ground. To do that, he said it's his job to make sure that all that water and that he maintains those minimum flows that already have been set, like at the Environmental Court one at Ophir and things like that. He has to put out to the people and say, you're not going to have any irrigation water because we're down too much and I've got to maintain that flow. That's what he just told me with an O-Rug, the lady Christina, the lawyer, just recently.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We
can clarify
detail.
That.
And that's why I think it's important, Madam Chair, we actually do get around the table and have an open workshop in Alex.
Yeah.
And then we perhaps have our closed workshop after that and then do your first schedule of public consultation, whatever goes out with that then. But I think it's important that we get the staff and those people at least around a table, if not all of us, in an open workshop manner.
Well,
and get these things sorted.
Quite clearly, the Resource Management Act requires us to consult with the community, and that is an open public forum.
Well, make it that, whatever.
And
it's all parties, yeah, fair enough. But make sure it happens.
Sorry?
We've just got to make sure that it happens.
It is definitely happening.
It's happening.
We've
had those meetings already in the community, and we will continue to have those meetings in that community.
Yeah, not the way they see it, though.
All right.
Yeah, that's where you're wrong.
We have entered into a formal consultation process, which we are proceeding with, and people have a chance to participate in that as much as they themselves want to, really. So it's over to those people to get involved, really. The opportunity is certainly there. Great. Anything else on this paper? Someone I must know?
It was just to remove section 5.
Oh, yeah, removing the section 5, and perhaps maybe we might want to have an update on regional transport.
Everything there, in fact, we updated it at council, last council meeting.
Yep, no, that's
well set out, thank you.
Right, thanks. Mm-hmm. So 5 goes with the attachments.
And then the reference to appendices after that.
Yeah, and then the recommendation.
Happy to move the recommendations, Madam Chair.
Yeah, the reports on waterways, the reports aren't there. So you won't want to move the recommendation.
So it's just remove. I'll move recommendation B.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
The report is noted.
Get a second that we note the report. Councillor Kempton, all in favour?
Aye.
Against? Carried. Thank you very much. Okay, now we have the next report on Resource Legislation Amendment Act, which I found a really useful paper. Thank you very much for putting this together. Certainly does open our eyes to the scale and extent of the changes that have been going on. So as we can see there, basically these changes have become law on the 18th of April. Mr. McCrae, do you want to comment on any of that?
Really, just to say that this is as Councillor Kempton said, does impact quite effectively on some of the underlying principles in the Resource Management Act, particularly in relation to opportunities for the public to be involved in processes under the Act. But that does primarily, a lot of it is around process and the bureaucracy under the Act rather than the actual outcomes or the functions of the that are intended under the Act. There is some there is a reference at 211 there to the stock exclusion rules from Waterways. Policy Manager Ms Meredith will be going to Wellington to a workshop with MFE around that topic, which they've called from people from around the country. And so it's, a lot of it is setting, the mechanism that is in here is setting up processes whereby detail will come later from the bureaucracy, and that's part of the templating for plans or the guidelines, whatever they're calling them nowadays. So there's work in progress in Wellington, Ministry for the Environment primarily, which will flesh out what these words actually will mean for us in the future.
Councillor Dacre,
yep, like you, Madam Chair, I found this part of the Director's Report both interesting and very useful. And what stood out was the publication from MFE, pages 96, 97, 98. I really liked the way that was done in terms of being a useful, informative checklist for councils. And it reminded me of the excellent work that Caroline and her crew did on Plan Change 1C, helping deem permit holders through a kind of a flow chart. And I wondered, looking at this, whether it's got potential for us to pinch that format and use it for Plan Change 6A. Or have we already done that? If we have, I don't recall it. But you start, you've got four columns. What's the topic that you're worried about? What part of the plan change actually refers to that? What do you have to do? If you want more information, where do you go to? I think that's really good. And I've asked the question of, is this applicable to 6A? And if it is, have we already done something like this?
That's right. So what we're currently working on for 6A is reconstructing what was known internally as the fact pack, which was the material that initially went out around 6A, and making that a lot more user-friendly, a lot more infographic,
yep,
the kind of style that 1C booklet was in. And then we're also looking at how we repackage that digital. So at the moment it's very static, sort of download PDFs.
Yep.
Whereas what we want to do is be able to serve that up in a user-friendly way to so they can catch more relevant information.
Cool.
So that works.
I like the sound of that. Through you, Madam Chair, Caroline, do you agree with me that that is quite a good format, the MFE one?
I confess to not being on that page right now.
Okay.
I'll be back to you.
Councillor Wogan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there's important changes in this piece of legislation, some of which it's good to see. Hazards are there, and we've advocated for them both as a council and as a wider sector for years, and it's now encoded. Great. And we've agreed with a number of the changes, but there's a couple that we just need some further clarification on, and Mr. McCrae, I think, has just referred to that with some assistance possibly coming out of Wellington. The Minister was of the view that the changes, I'm referring to paragraph 2.4, that the changes that he was making to the legislation was going to deal with our issue about charging for the monitoring of committed activities. This is the one that we're all very aware of, is the dairy farm inspections. But there's others. And hopefully that's because the regional sector and OIC were very clear that that was what was required. So hopefully that covers our issue there. And, so Mr. McCrae, once we get some feedback from MFE on their interpretation and guidance around this legislation, we'll be able to have a more detailed look.
Yep.
on a couple of those ones. Yep. So there's that one I think we need to keep an eye on. The other one that frankly horrifies me, and it's made it through, is 2.5, where a minister's actually got an ability to put a national environmental standard in at a regional level. So no matter what the region's decided, our community's decided, a minister on the whims of whatever is able to step in and just write some rules or policy that that's concerning, very concerning from my perspective, and it's made its way through despite some quite strong opposition. The other one that I'm hoping we is fit for purpose for ORC and a number of councils, and on the way through the process and through the submissions there was an endeavour to make this the case, is 2.7, the iwi participation arrangements. And so I think we'll need to sit down with our local Te Rupatia group and look at the legislation and understand where there are existing arrangements which are under review currently, and we're endeavouring to develop a combined charter or agreement with Otago and Southland across all the Runanga and all councils. And so we'll no doubt have a look at this, how it's landed, and hopefully make our a new document fit purpose to be suitable as an iwi participation arrangement.
Just before you leave that topic, there is a inclusion in the amendment that when we create a hearing panel, we will need to seek a view from iwi whether there should be an iwi representative / member on that panel. So that would be for a plan change, a resource consent potentially, any hearing panel that we hold under the RMA, we will need to approach iwi to see if there is a requirement for a representation on that panel.
All right, and again, there's some detail there to be worked through.
Yeah, that's part of that relationship.
The iwi, My last comment is just to reinforce the 2.11. Good to hear there's been a number of staff called to Wellington next week, and Mrs. Meredith's going to be there on our behalf. The stock exclusion is, I mean, our policy doesn't fit with what was drafted earlier, and because we've got a permitted activity base on the effects of stock access to waterways, and whereas what's proposed quite prescriptive and described, but in my view, you cannot deal with this issue on a degree of slope, for example, to define hill country as against rolling country as against flat. And we've already had a number of questions from farmers in areas such as the Matukituki Valley, where you've got a high country in a small area of flat. So I think it's something we need to keep an eye on, and it could be a significant issue for us with respect to implementation of that policy if it doesn't have some flexibility around how the stock exclusion and where it is managed on a region by region or catchment by catchment basis.
I think they're good comments, and certainly significant changes. Councillor Scott, wasn't it?
2.10, subdivision of natural hazards. And it basically says that subdivision applications in cap consent only can only be declined if the activity was non-complying status. Whereas previously, I assume, Mr. McRae, that an area might have a designation discretionary, and the ORC as an affected party might turn up and say, well, actually, we've got some concerns here about this, this and this, and oppose, and on that basis it could be declined. Whereas, so the status is changing, and it's making quite clear that if it's non-compliant, that they do have the ability to carry on, probably subject to conditions. I mean, what I'm taking out of this is real onus that we get our hazard maps up to date, integrated in the district plans, and that we have some confidence in them, yeah, as opposed to hearing that people are making subdivisions in areas that we have concerns about. Is that true? Like, hey, I'm going to just sort of talk us through what's actually changing here.
We'll never have perfect knowledge for a start.
Yeah, that's true.
We'll never have perfect knowledge for a start. This is some of the tensions and the conflicts that are involved in all of this, because on one hand they've elevated natural hazards from other matters up to a matter of national importance to be considered. And then here in the process and the mechanism, they go, you can only decline the subdivision on the hazards point of view if it's a non-complying activity. If it's a discretionary, restricted discretionary, you've got to approve it, presumably with some conditions. So on one hand they've said we want greater recognition of the impact of natural hazards, and on this hand they've said process wise you can only say no if. So there's this sort of tension and conflict in there. Then there's another layer across all of that, which is, and the point I think you're hinting at, is that the Resource Management Act sets up a context. There's a regional policy statement that sets up something, and it's supposed to be regionalising the Resource Management Act, and then you have a district plan below that. And the way the court is now working is suggesting that all you need to consider is the plan, because the plan should be implementing the regional policy statement that is implementing the Act. So therefore, this is doing the work of all of those documents at the local level.
Yeah.
And so there's no reference back to Part 2 of the Act or anything else, essentially, if you've got that system set up properly. In an ideal world, very easy and very nice.
Tidy.
Sorry. Like, so we get these regular updates, for example, on the BCC, and there's the 2GP plan, and we're working closely with them and doing well. But what about elsewhere around the region? How robust, maybe if Dr. Palmer was here, but how robust are our hazard maps? I know we're making progress, and from where we were 5 years ago, we've done an amazing amount. But how robust are they, you know, Kiwa and Queenstown and Central Otago?
We've done a lot of work across Otago, and yep. Queenstown Lakes District has had a lot of work put into it, from the landslide, the physical disruption of the ground stuff, as well as from flooding concepts as well. And we have been a regular submitter again, or into submissions for developments of various types, subdivisions and developed various types, particularly in Queenstown Lakes.
That's
been the most responded to area.
Are we there yet, though? Like, how far down the track are we? You know, probably a question for Tom, but, you know, like, are we 70% of the way there in terms of our hazard maps and, like, include the district? You know, can they rely on our hazard maps to do a subdivision anywhere that the hazard maps are different colour?
Well, they're not site-specific for a start. We haven't got the resource to be able to do a site-specific analysis of hazard across a target. So we have a more granular, district-appropriate level of work across Otago. So it sort of suggests that there's probably no issue to deal with here, or you need to get somebody in to do some site-specific work in relation to overland flow or fan morphology or landslide or something else, from the work, the preliminary work that we've got done.
Thank you.
I guess the problem is if you have got granular type level and it's showing, over this sort of district or whatever, there's this sort of risk and it's medium, but at a site specific it might be high, and your plan hasn't covered that, and then you've got the no ability to oppose now, you know. Those types of issues, exactly, Councillor Scott. Anyway, we're getting into detail, which isn't what we're aiming at again. We've got Councillor Deaker and then Councillor Neil.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. I could have made this comment earlier when we were talking about potential submissions to the Urban Development Authority and the Better Urban Planning Papers, but then this RMA stuff kind of came on top of it. And I just want to get it off my chest. It's all about growth, and that's fine. I know our country's going through in areas, rapid growth phases, and it's got to be accommodated. But what bothers me is the complete absence of any of this of the word landscape. And I would posit that much of the growth we're seeing, including here in Otago, is not recognising the significance, the economic importance, and the grandeur of our natural landscapes. I'm thinking particularly so of the big box developments just out of Queenstown, which would be relatively at home in Albany, or some of those other areas of much less significant landscape. But when you plant them against the foot of the remarkables, and more or less on the edge of the shot over and the Lake Wakatu, it's just hideous. And yet all of this planning development doesn't say anything anywhere about the quality of design and how it should be sympathetic and congruent with the landscape in which it's set. And that's enabling growth to severely diminish the quality of our unique landscapes in Otago. And that seriously troubles me. How can anybody put together these planning regimes and not include the word landscape? It is just so dumb.
Councillor Law is on the same subject.
Sorry, can I just respond to that quickly?
Yes.
That first of all, that this is not a comprehensive planning regime. These are amendments to the current planning regime. Landscape is in the current regime.
But it can override our RPS, and our RPS talks about landscape.
Yeah.
But this is saying, oh, push that aside.
But in the case of microsites, I just want to clarify, if I might, isn't it the Queensland Lakes District Council that provide planning permission for those big box developments?
Yep.
Yes. So the argument really is with them, not with.
And they have in their district plan, they have landscape maps and provisions around significant landscapes, outstanding landscapes. Various qualities of landscape, and essentially, at some point, who is the arbiter of good taste, and should any development go into that landscape? And that's a debate that Mackenzie District Council is having. Should the brown pasture, the sorrel, and the annual grasses be allowed to be turned green because of the landscape implications of it?
You can get into all those abstruse arguments if you want to, but just going back to the examples I quoted, on one side of Queenstown Airport you've got a development which was clearly done with the landscape in mind. It's very well done. Anybody would think that. You go to the other side of the airport.
Okay, we better keep on rolling, I think.
We have those big boxes.
Yep, we could discuss landscape all afternoon, I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Can I ask the question that Stephen raised to do with the National Environmental Standards, which is the biggest issue here, it seems. And that is, just to clarify, if I might, the Minister has indicated over a number of years now that he is disconcerted by the different ways in which regional councils approach environmental standards and responsibilities. Mm-hmm. So national environmental standards have been put in place to address those ups and downs, peaks and troughs. I just wanted to clarify that what the Minister is proposing, or has been the Parliament have granted power now, is for the Minister to specify an area. What's the difference between what's in the legislation and what they currently already can do, which is to impose national environmental standards on all regional councils?
My understanding is that it clarifies the granularity of it. So the Minister, at the moment, there is national environmental standards on air quality, for example, on metering and measuring water taken, that sort of stuff. my understanding is, though, that this is allowing the minister to create a national environmental standard for the Wakatipu Basin.
Right, so he could say, to answer the Mackenzie thing, this is a national treasure.
Yep.
Isn't the environmental standard likely to be of a higher nature than a lower?
Can't guarantee you that. It's a political... It comes from Parliament.
Yes, but that is a decision-making and publicly accountable organisation.
Well, ultimately it's the Minister that does the particular environmental standard and perhaps not the whole of Parliament.
Right. He's only in the government got elected, though.
Hmm.
Yeah.
It's a worrying principle in my mind as well.
Yes.
Okay, Councillor Neil?
Oh, it's a relative here. Mine about longevity in that MFE checklist, objections to consents, which we have an objection committee, and but here it says incorporate, well, I'm assuming it says incorporate independent commissioner changes. Does that mean that the objections committee is disbanded, and also who pays the cost of, presumably the objector pays the cost of the commissioner?
How does that work, Mr. McRae? Have you got
your
mind to that one yet?
Very briefly.
Yeah.
First of all, the objection committee will remains, and the amendments that are there are in relation to if I have an objection to some charge that the council's given me, I can ask for an independent commissioner who is not a councillor to hear that, and then there's some controls around what the council, the commissioner can do. So effectively you have the choice of coming, as is the current situation, you come to the council with your objection, or you can ask for a commissioner to hear it, and the council must appoint a commissioner to hear that objection. And as is other places where you call for a independent commissioner, you pay those charges. I can't quite confirm that that's the same situation here, but I would imagine the logic of consistency would say that if you want to go outside the normal process, then you pay the cost of doing
it. Right. Any other matters then? Had a good discussion on this one. No doubt there will be further papers as we actually need to implement these, or any of them actually affect us. Okay, so we have a recommendation there that the report is received. Somebody care to move that? Councillor Hope, second to Councillor Kempton, all in favour?
Mm-hmm.
Carried. Okay, next paper. Environment Court Mediation. Paper sought as one of our actions. Would like to start this one off. Councillor Laws?
Well, it was Brian and I that brought it, raised the issue, and can I say, excellent response. But thank God we did ask, because it does mean that we can be reported back to and find things out.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is going to measurably improve the level of transparency around our council table. I think it's fantastic. Thank you.
Look, I actually think, well, yeah, I actually think that the track record of staff and mediation, they've got a very good track record and confidence and so forth. I think as a councillor, if there was any question marks in my mind, it would probably be in terms of, one, in terms of being kept up to date with progress, and secondly, to get an appropriate debrief at the end. You know, like I've, you know, sat on hearing panels, and you've come to a particular conclusion, and then you find out through mediation there's a different outcome. And you know, even from a learning basis, what gave, what was the issue that actually gave, or was it simply a compromise? So there's certainly that expectation as a councillor. I too like this report. I was drawn to the final bullet point in section 3 where it says if a mediated outcome requires endorsement by elected members, and then I thought, is that an option
in certain mediated situations, because what we as a council basically say is we delegate our power to staff to do a job and have confidence in them. But the reference here to the third bullet point is that there may be situations where we give that delegation, but we say, ultimately, you come back with the deal, but we have to approve it.
That's not right. How the delegation's set up at the moment, though.
No,
so I guess if the party who was in mediation, which would then be our delegated person, chose to consult somebody, they could choose to consult with us.
But that's why we've got this report, because we're reviewing those terms of delegation.
Yeah.
You know, like if you know, one, we're going to understand it, but two, we after we've understood it, we're saying, we're asking ourselves, is there any opportunity for improvement, or why should we break it as working?
The situation you first described, which was, I've got the delegation in a sense for this to go, Dr. Palmer has delegation as well. If we were sent off to go and mediate with the, you must come back and get approval from us first, essentially you're tying our hands behind our backs and we aren't really able to mediate particularly well. But I can envisage a situation where to strike the deal, we have to agree to spending $500,000 next financial year investigating something.
Yeah.
That's sort of well beyond the concept of the delegation I've got, and I would have to say, I cannot agree with that, I will have to take that back to my council. So it would be that sort of situation where we would seek it rather than be sent off without any delegation.
I say it again, it's worked well, but there may be issues that are that particularly sensitive where we as a governance body actually say, well, we want you to negotiate this, but we want you to come back before you sign the deal. Madam Chair, you're saying that's not in their terms.
Well, no, because we've delegated our authorities to specific officers, so
we couldn't suddenly just decide to put
controls on those officers.
So what I'm saying, Madam Chair, is that, you know, who's to say we have the ability to change those terms?
Of
course you can.
I disagree with Mr. McRae that, you know, that how can they negotiate if somebody's got their head on the shoulder? Hey, welcome to the real world. We all have, you know, whether you're in the commercial world, you set out to negotiate something, but then you have to go back to your MD to get the final sign of it. That's just part of the game. But, so I'm just sort of saying, but I'm not rocking the boat. I'm just, it's been a good informative report, and I appreciate that.
Yeah. Now, you're relying on the professionalism of those who have been delegated a job to do, to say, this is now in a situation where I can agree up to this point, but if we were going to go further than this, I'm going to go back. I need to go back to my council to talk to them before we proceed further. Yeah. So you're relying on some integrity and some professionalism of the people who've got their delegation.
But isn't also the issue that if we fail to give you adequate terms of reference, then that factors out at the end of the day?
Right, we had some hands up as well.
Sorry,
Councillor Woodhead and Councillor Kempton.
So you and Mr. McRae, you clarified what I was essentially going to say, and I can't remember the specific example, but that has happened out of mediation at some point. It might have an impact on the funding policy.
Yes, that's right.
Can't be dealt with, so it's brought back to council before mediation is concluded.
Thanks, Councillor Kempton.
I absolutely understand that the opportunity to bring a potential, you know, a possible mediated settlement back to council is more in the toolbox of the mediator or the person involved in mediation on our behalf rather than us necessarily saying, but we've got to go know this, we've got to know who's got to know that. I think it's an important backstop for the person doing the work. But the only thing that strikes me with this, of course, is that it's relatively complex to the extent that in council being involved in anything like this, the disciplines that are imposed upon council are significant and complex. And I think that if anything does come back, we ought to be reminded and be given a little guidance every time.
on exactly how we should be conducting ourselves with respect to what's under discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, really appreciate this paper. It is a really useful paper. Thank you. Anybody else want to comment then before we go to recommendation? No? Somebody care to remove that it's noted? Councillor Lord.
No, I'm sorry, I was putting it my hand. I'm sorry, I'll second whatever you can second that.
Oh! Your moment. Yeah. Councillor Lord has seconded.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you. All in favour?
Aye.
Against? Carried. Thank you very much. That brings the Policy Committee to a close.
Good discussion. Thank you.